Good morning, everyone. You are in session 220, Legacy of Interconnection, Planned Giving Made Easy. If anyone wasn't expecting to be here and leaves now, we won't take it personally. But it is really great to see such a big crowd interested in planned giving. My name is Laura Randall. I work for Your UUA as the Legacy Gifts Manager, which means that I help both individuals and congregations with planned giving. And part of that work is here today. And Tim Brennan is treasurer for our UUA, and he'll say a bit more when he comes up to speak, but he's our other presenter this morning. Can everyone hear me okay with the mics? Good? Little soft? I will speak up a bit. Thank you. All right, to get started, why should we promote planned giving in our congregations? And before I get started with that, I just want to say the slideshow will be available online, so take the notes you wish, but know that this will be available for you later. All right, why promote planned giving? The biggest one is you don't want to leave money on the table, so to speak. The biggest reason people say why they gave a planned gift is because someone asked them to. So if you're not talking about planned giving, there's money out there that you're just not going to get. You're going to be taking advantage of automatic touches, which is fundraising speak for connections you have with your donors. But touches you have are once a week, maybe more, with everyone who's a potential donor to your congregation. That's more than any other nonprofit ever gets. Once a week, maybe more? Gosh, the Red Cross would love that kind of face-to-face interaction with people. And another thing is you could use bequests in a time of need. Depending on how you decide as a congregation to use planned gift money that comes in, sometimes bequests can really save you from a hard time. So a planned gift is often the largest gift an individual is capable of making. A gift from an estate is usually a pretty significant gift and is very meaningful. It strengthens the bond between a congregation and an individual. Because who do we put in our wills? Children, grandchildren, family, maybe good friends, people we love, exactly. So if someone says that your congregation is in their will, they've just said, this congregation is like family to me. And that's a really meaningful statement. That's profound. Also, if you know about planned gifts beforehand, if it's not just a surprise, which sometimes they are, and there will always be surprises, and those can be really nice, but you can have a really meaningful discussion beforehand. If you find out that someone's put your congregation in their will, you can thank them, you can talk about why they've made such a gift, and have a really great conversation about that relationship that they're honoring in this way. You can also talk about the particulars of a gift, if they put any restrictions on it, and sometimes you can head off trouble before it starts. So let's say that someone loves your congregation, and they also really love animals. And after they pass away, you find out they've left a significant bequest to start an animal shelter in your congregation's basement. Right? And there's a good chance that you're not going to be able to use that bequest money in that way, and that's a shame. Because if you had had a conversation earlier on, you could have talked to this person about their passions and talked about how to make this bequest that could be in keeping with the spirit of both of these passions, perhaps, but also something the congregation could use. So what are planned gifts? Simply put, planned gifts are any gift that require planning, negotiation, and counseling. I like to say they're anything more complicated, really, than writing a check or sending some cash. They can be immediate, such as gifts of stock, and they can become infinitely more complicated with gifts of trusts and things like that. So it really runs the gamut. With everything we talk about today, I love to remind people you don't need to be an expert. You don't have to remember everything I say. You basically just need to know the simple concepts, know that these things exist, so that when someone brings it up, you can say, oh yes, this reminds me of that thing Laura said in that workshop that I went to at GA, and I can tell that person to talk to Laura and she can give them the information. So you don't need to be an expert, you just need to know someone who is. And you do now. So what are the basic plan giving options? The most common one is a bequest that's made through a will. We also have deferred and life income gifts, and we're going to talk a bit more about that, but those are gifts where you give a gift and get income for life. And then there's outright gifts of appreciated assets, such as stock and real estate. So starting with bequest intentions, since they are the most popular, they make up 80 to 90% of all planned gifts. And this is across the board, in congregations, at nonprofits everywhere, colleges, hospitals, 80 to 90%. They're usually made through a will and sometimes a trust. And they're usually revocable. And that's something to keep in mind. You can come into the will, and you can be written out of it. And as I said before, they usually represent the ultimate gift someone is going to give. And you are family now when someone has put you in their will. And you need to honor the relationship in that way. So there's different kinds of bequests you can put in. We encourage people to put in percent bequests, that's a percentage of your estate, as opposed to a fixed amount. There's a couple reasons for this. Most people assume that their net worth is less than it actually is. So a percentage is usually going to be more than a fixed amount. That, and if I were to leave $1,000 as a fixed amount to the UUA in my will, by the time I finally pass away, hundreds and hundreds of years from now, that $1,000 is going to have much less purchasing power than it does when I originally made the gift. So that's another reason to encourage percentages. And most people are comfortable with saying, you know, my kids can get 95% of my estate. That'll be enough for them. 5% can go to the causes I love. Oh, before I move on, residuary bequests are bequests that people can put into their will that say, after all these obligations are made to my family in certain ways, if there's anything left, that goes to the congregation. And some people are more comfortable with that sort of language. They need to take care of their family, and that's important. So if there's anything left, that goes to the congregation. Life income gifts. So these are where you can give and get income. They're a win-win situation. They're for people 65 and older, generally, and you can make them from highly appreciated assets in order to save on capital gains tax. And these are irrevocable gifts. So once you give the money, that's it. There's no taking it back. So the two most popular kinds are charitable gift annuities, which we're going to talk more about, and charitable remainder trusts. And I can touch on that a little bit. Those tend to be a bit more complicated. There's more startup costs, but they're also highly customizable. So for certain people, charitable remainder trusts are a great option for plan giving. So charitable gift annuities. This is a program run by our UUA, and we can all do this together through our combined power. Our charitable gift annuities are for one or two lives. People often do it with their spouse. But it's anyone who's over 65, so it can be you and a sibling, you and a good friend. As long as both people are 65 or older, you count. As I mentioned before, you can earn income from highly appreciated securities. These payments are guaranteed by our UUA, and the program is administered by State Street Bank, and we've had a long-term relationship with them, and they do a great job, and they do this for a lot of nonprofit organizations. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about planned gift annuities or charitable gift annuities before I move on. So a charitable gift annuity, as an example, is if you give $10,000 and depending on your age at the time, you will get a fixed percentage of that money back as an annuity. And you get a quarterly payment for the rest of your life. And if you have two lives on it, the survivor gets the entire amount as well. So the entire benefit goes to the survivor. And that fixed percentage is tied to your age. So if you're 65, it's about 4.1% right now. If you're age 70, it's closer to 7%. And if you're 90, it's 9%. So it's pretty good return, especially when you look at what your mutual funds might be giving you. So who gives planned gifts in congregations? I like to say, don't assume. Everyone's a planned giving prospect, and that's true. But there's certain things to look for. Do they attend every service? Are they serving on a board or a committee? Are they an active lay leader? Are they a surviving spouse? Are they someone without children? And are they alumni? And alumni are really important to pay attention to, because people who have been a part of your congregation for a long time but perhaps move away to be closer to children, perhaps they move into a retirement home and they don't attend church services regularly like they used to anymore. But that connection with the congregation is still really important. And if you stay in touch with them, keep sending them newsletters, send them cards, phone calls once in a while, to really honor that relationship, that's huge. Just because they move away doesn't mean that relationship is over. So remember your alumni. And often what you're looking for in plan gifts is people update their wills when something significant happens in their life. So oftentimes the first time someone makes a will, it's when they get married or maybe have their first child. People look at their wills again, maybe update them at the death of a family member, chronic illness strikes, these sorts of things that kind of shake us up a little bit and remind us that we're not going to live forever and we need to look at our affairs. The thing is, you don't know when this is going to happen in anyone's life, which is part of why promoting plan giving in your congregation now and being consistent in that reminding will have it so when people do have these life events occur, they already have it in their mind because you've been reminding them that leaving an estate gift to the congregation is a possibility. So when that time comes, they are going to update their will. They're thinking of you already. So how are you going to promote plan giving in your congregation? Well, you're going to want to educate your congregation about some of the things I've just been telling you about, such as this is a possibility. You can do this through newsletter inserts, order of service inserts, testimonials, and that's some of my favorite ways to do it. There's nothing more powerful than hearing someone's story, and it's just really simple, 5 minutes or less of, I gave a planned gift to my congregation, this is why I did it, and this is how I did it. And the how is important, too, because it's really important to remind people that this is easy and fairly simple to do. You can have information sessions. You can have something like this. Sometimes I can even come to your congregation or do a webinar. You can have people from the community come in, such as estate planning attorneys can come in and do a brief seminar with your people. You can also do blocks of workshops for people. And this has been working really well in a lot of congregations to have a series of adult education opportunities that deal with end-of-life issues. So one session, you might have a hospice nurse come in and talk about advanced directives, or you might have a geriatric doctor come in, or that estate planning attorney, and also have the minister come and talk about the spirituality of end-of-life times. So all of these things work together, and incorporating stewardship into those conversations is very important and powerful. And the congregations I know of that have done this, they find that a few people come to the first session and then word of mouth builds. And by the end of it, they're adding chairs and people are just dropping by. People are hungry for this kind of information. You can create a brochure rack, and we have many brochures that you can use or modify for your own use at our UUA, and we'll have information about how to get those later. The most important thing is to make it as easy as possible for people to access this information and use it. And then you're going to want to create a recognition society for the people who said they're making planned gifts to your congregation. This helps you stay in touch with the people who said they've made this commitment. It creates stronger bonds. You can hold members-only events. These can be a lot of fun. Sometimes it's a concert that you all go to together, or a museum trip, or even just a nice dinner party. And for those nice dinner parties, it's great to have members host them at their own homes, and that's another great community-building event. And you're going to want to make a list of charter members. And if you're first getting started and you don't have a legacy society yet, I recommend that you get 4 or 5 people to be your founding members so that when you launch this, there's already some people in the group. You can create an oral history project, and this is really a fantastic way to get stories about the congregation. Similar to the NPR StoryCorps model. Buddy programs are fantastic, of linking older members of the congregation with some of the youth and having them be pen pals or maybe just lunch sometimes. It's a nice intergenerational thing to do. They can become honorary members of the stewardship team. People who've made planned gifts are very committed to the health and vibrancy of the congregation and its longevity, and so they have a lot of good ideas about stewardship, so ask them about them. Also, having them be guests in religious education classes, either to speak about something that they're passionate about or extremely knowledgeable about, or to help out in the classroom. So you've got this program going. How are you going to know if it's working? Recommend you review it every 3 years, and it's going to take about 3 years, maybe even a little more, before you really start seeing anything that's worth reviewing. Plan giving is a long game, so you have to start now and you'll start seeing results later on. So every 3 years we recommend a review. In this way you can determine patterns of gifts, what you tried and what's working, what gets responses. Get feedback from people about how they're feeling about what you're trying. Learn from and with other congregations. And this is really important, and there's a lot of great information out there and out here from all the people and all the congregations that have done this work before, what they've tried, what's worked well, what hasn't. Learning from each other is really key. And we recommend the appreciative inquiry approach, which is, what are we doing well? What are our strengths in this, and how can we build on those? And now I'm going to turn it over to Tim to talk a little bit about endowments and how they link to plan giving.
Thanks, Laura. Yes, so hi, I'm Tim Brennan. I'm the treasurer, chief financial officer of the association, and I do spend a lot of my time on endowment. And plan gifts, bequests, and other plan gifts is a great way to build the endowment of your congregation. So this quote here is actually from a book by Wayne Clark. He says, many people support endowments because they want to make a difference in a lasting way, to leave a legacy for the future. They expect their contributions to be invested wisely, to grow in value, and to produce a reliable revenue stream in perpetuity. It is their brush with eternity and generations to come. So what I want to talk to you about today is to talk about the legal framework of endowments, the governance of endowments, spending policy, how to manage those investments, and then some specifics about the Unitarian Universalist Common Endowment Fund, which you're all eligible to invest in. It's just one option, but it may be a good one. So the legal framework. First of all, we use the term endowment rather loosely. In fact, it's even used loosely in the name of our fund, the UU Common Endowment Fund. So there's a difference between endowment and quasi-endowment. What an endowment is when a donor makes a gift to an organization, to your congregation, and places a restriction on it. And the one we usually have in mind is they're giving you the funds, but they only want you to use the payout from that over time, and not to touch the principal. You'll also have situations where you might get a bequest without any restriction, and the board will say, we're going to put it in the endowment. And the key thing to understand there is that even if the board decides, or even the congregation through congregational action decides, we want this invested in our endowment fund, that restriction does not encumber the future. Any future... So the board says, we're going to treat this like a permanent endowment. That board goes out, the new board comes in, they say, you know what, we're not. And that's how it works. You cannot place a restriction on the future. So it's important first to understand that, and second of all, when you set up your systems, to actually track that. So you're tracking those true endowments. If you do get the restriction that says, here's $1 million and it's a permanent endowment and the income can only be used for the animal shelter in the basement. You are legally bound by that. And the only way out of that restriction is to go to a court or a state agency. And it varies by state, and it also varies by amount. In Massachusetts, so all our whole endowment fund is governed by the rules of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The limit is $75,000. So if it's $75,000 or less, you can go to the office of the state attorney general, the charitable regulation department, and you can appeal to them to change restrictions. If it's over that, you need to go to a court. And this can be done. I mean, we just did this at the UUA about 4 years ago. We had something like 400 restricted funds, many of them from the 19th century, early 20th century, and some of them with some very odd restrictions on them. My favorite was the fund for the support of decrepit gentlewomen. So we went to the court and we said, you know, can we combine these and use, still restricted, but we're going to use it for the support of retired ministers and their survivors. And they were fine with that. And the 400 funds became four. So that is possible. The restricted portion of your endowment, that part that is restricted by the donor in his or her bequest or other gift instrument, is governed by a law called the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, or UPMIFA. This is state law, but I think 49 states have adopted some form of this law, and it's a very similar one to another. So that's sort of your restriction. That's what guides you. Governance. So I hear from congregations frequently that we want to protect the endowment, and we're going to do that by setting up the endowment as a separate legal entity. We're going to create a foundation. We're going to create a trust. And what I want to do is really caution you about that. It comes with a lot of baggage. You know, the advantage would be you have an entity which is purely focused on the endowment. But what you end up with is a dual governance structure. So you have this board of the endowment, and they're deciding how the money's invested and also what it's used for. And then you have the board of the congregation. And this is not abstract. I mean, I have dealt with many congregations that have long-standing, deep-seated, embedded conflicts between the folks that are overseeing the endowment and the folks that are responsible for running the congregation. What you really want is everything focused on the mission of the congregation and coordinated. Now, I feel a little guilty because the UUA, under my leadership, actually set up a separate legal entity several years ago, and I fear that people see that as an example. But the thing to understand about our structure is that while it is a separate legal entity, is essentially a wholly owned subsidiary. So it is a separate entity, but is subject to the governance of the UUA Board of Trustees. They set the bylaws, they appoint the investment committee, so they control that entity. So it doesn't have that problem. The reason we did it is because we have all of you investing in this common endowment fund, but prior to this structure, what you essentially did was give us the money. It became the UUA's money, subject to a contract, but in a legal action, it was technically possible, we were told by legal counsel, for a judge to award those assets in a legal settlement. So we set up that structure to protect the congregations, and that's the only reason for it. So I think the alternative is to have an investment committee, which is appointed by the board or can be elected by your congregation, and to have really clear policies. By the way, just make some noise if I go on too long.
Okay.
I get going on this stuff. I'm sort of interested in it. But to have a really clear policy structure for the endowment that states what the purpose of it is, including that quasi-endowment piece. So that when people are thinking about a bequest or they're thinking about a charitable gift annuity, they can have faith in the congregation that if they leave the money to this fund, with or without a restriction, that is going to be well managed, that it's going. They're going to understand what the money will actually be used for. They can have confidence that it won't be frittered away in a few months. Going back to that first quote, that it is their brush with eternity. That this is something which is going to. They're going to take their life savings, bequest it to the congregation, and it's going to benefit the congregation long into the future. And you do that by having these clear structures, by having people understand how the money is managed, and by having people understand the oversight. And it's also very important, in my opinion, to have clear accountability to the congregation. Again, in these separate structures, sometimes you have these groups, and this is not abstract, this is real. They don't want to tell the congregation how much is in the endowment. Really. They don't want to tell what the return for the endowment is, because that's their job. It's not their business. So I think you really want. And by the way, the UUA's own endowment is entirely transparent. You can go on the website any month and see exactly how much is in there, what the return is. There's a wealth of information about it. So that we try to model that. And if whether or not you use the common endowment, we think that's the right model for our congregations as well. So one of the key things that you will have to decide is what is your spending policy. So you have this endowment, some of it may be true endowment, permanent endowment, but then you're also going to treat another chunk of it as endowment, and you're going to try to preserve that principal in perpetuity, or in the case of a real restriction, you're obligated to by UPMIFA. You have to protect that principal in perpetuity. So you have to decide how much of that comes out for actually spending on current purposes. The term that's thrown around a lot is income. That's actually the wrong term. What income means in this world I travel in is interest and dividends. And some, 20, 30 years ago, that's how endowments were managed. You invest the money, and the only thing you spent was the dividends and the interest. But what people realized was this was pushing endowments into very conservative investments that didn't grow. Bonds or conservative high dividend stocks. And what people saw was the growth stocks, Google, those stocks, people were not investing in those things. So the concept shift, and this is governed again by UPMIFA, and there was a previous law called UMIFA, but it was the same principle that deals with total return. So it's looking at interest, dividends, capital gains, and capital losses. So what's the total return for the fund? And then you determine a payout rate. Typically these days, it's actually more like 4% is considered prudent. Because returns have not been so good over the last several years. So to have a perpetual endowment paying out 4% every year tends to make some sense. What most institutions do is to come up with a policy which doesn't just look at the current year. We all know the market's up, the market's down, and if you're tying your payout, your 4%, to the value of your endowment, it's going like this. It's bouncing all over the place. So there are different tools that can be used. Some do use the fixed percentage. A lot use a 3-year rolling average or a 5-year rolling average. So what's the average asset value over the last 3 years? Then we take 4% of that. There are also models that say that take the payout and just adjust it for inflation. And then there's something called the Yale model, which is actually what the UUA does. And that takes a mixture between the inflation-adjusted weighted average, the inflation-adjusted payout and the percentage of assets, and applies a weight to each. So in our case, we look at the adjustment in the CPI or the spending, the inflation rate. We weight that 70%. So in other words, if we paid out $1 million last year and inflation was 3%, this year we'll pay out $1,030,000. And then if the assets went up, you know, by 10% in the year, then we'll weight that 30%. And you come up with this blended average. So in all these cases, you're going to actually have years where the value of the assets are going to go down, but your three-year rolling average, of course, doesn't go down as much, and you're going to be paying out more. So you're actually going to be chipping into that principle. But this is considered prudent under these laws, up MIFA, so you are allowed to do that because your focus should be on the long term. What is your best understanding of the likely return of this fund over the long term? And if you are prudently spending at a rate which, given those assumptions, is going to, over time, add to or keep the principal at the same value adjusted for inflation, then that is considered prudent. It's allowed by trust law. And then the last thing here is what guides this whole thing is a concept called intergenerational equity. And what this means is there is a right payout rate. If the payout rate is too low, what you're doing is penalizing the current generation. I mean, let's just say the fund is for scholarships. That means you're paying out less in scholarships to current students, and you're going to benefit some future generation. On the other hand, let's say your fund is earning 5% a year and you're paying out 7%. Well, that means you're privileging the current generation of students, and you're going to penalize the future. You're taking money from them in order to benefit the current generation. So what the law says, and actually what our moral guidance says, is we're trying to strike the right balance there. We don't want to pay out too little, but we don't want to pay out too much, because we're trying. It's a perpetual endowment. It's to benefit now and the future, and we want that balance. The last thing to say, and this is the exception, is when you're in that point, you know, working on your planned gifts and bequests, and let's say you've raised $30,000, well, you may not actually want to pay out anything yet. You know, and that's this concept of the accumulation period. You might want to say, we have an active program to build this up, and we're going to start payouts at $500,000. But we're going to allow ourselves 5 years to accumulate that much. Now, eventually, maybe you don't get there, and then you have to revisit that concept. But it is permissible to have an accumulation period where you're building up the endowment to the point that you think makes sense. So now you've got the money, and you need to manage the money. There's a concept called the endowment model, and it's really it was pioneered by David Swensen, who is the endowment manager for Yale, which has been highly successful over many, many years. He has a few books, but one I would recommend is called Unconventional Success. And what this talks about is, first of all, diversification of the portfolio. So it's not the old model where we do stocks and bonds. It's really trying to diversify over asset classes, over multiple managers. So you may have U.S. equities, but you don't maybe necessarily want to load it all up on one manager. You want a little bit of diversification there, if you can. Geography, it's not all about the U.S., folks. About 70% of investable assets are not in the U.S., so think about that domestic bias that many people have. And within asset classes, you know, we have stocks and bonds, but we also have emerging markets. We have developed markets. If they're available to you, there are different vehicles like asset allocation funds, hedge funds. And by mixing what Swensen says is by having a highly diversified portfolio, you will get less volatility over time, so less of this, and you will also get the same or a better return. And then what you do as an investment committee is that you set asset allocation targets. This is in his book. So that you're looking at, we're going to do, 10% to U.S. large cap equities, 5% to U.S. small cap equities, 10% to international equities, et cetera. And then periodically, in the case of the UUA, it's every quarter, we go back and we rebalance back to those targets. So let's say the last quarter's been great, U.S. stocks, and that went way up. We're actually going to take that back down and put it back into bonds, or take it out of U.S. and put it into international. And that's because we're not doing market timing. You never know when you're up and when you're down. But by having your focus on the long term and you keep rebalancing back to these targets, you're essentially buying low and selling high. So when you get out of balance because your stocks are way up, that means that the stocks are high and you're going to bring that back down, and the bonds are low and you're going to move the money there. And then the last thing to say here is that the focus is really on these strategic asset allocation targets. There's some fascinating research that shows that college endowment investment committees get 90% of the value out of their decisions over strategic asset allocation and about 10% out of the managers they select. They also found in this study that the balance of how the time is spent is almost the reverse. They're always talking about, you know, what about this guy? He's low this quarter. You know, should we take it out of there and give it to this fund? And should we sell that fund? And by it makes almost no difference, because if you look at returns, let's say for U.S. equity managers, they really bunch around the benchmark. And especially when you look at 3 and 5 years, there's not a whole lot of variability. That's not to say that you don't want the best managers you can get. But where value really comes from is thinking up about how much do we want in international? How much do we want in domestic? How much should be in bonds? What's going on in bonds? That kind of thinking actually is what delivers the value. The other point he makes, which is very important, is, so what I'm talking about with this asset allocation, adjusting, rebalancing, it's not market timing. He says, and there's a ton of data that supports this, there's market timing is a loser's game. And that's because if you look at long-term returns, you see these lines that look sort of straight or light curved. When you drill down into the short term, what you see is that market fluctuations happen in bursts, and it's so easy to miss the burst. So it's better just to be in the market. So the last thing to talk about is just our UU Common Endowment Fund. So this approach, this Swenson Endowment Model that I was just talking about, is what guides our fund. It's open to any of you, congregations, districts, regions, and other UU organizations can be in the fund. It's very much a long-term horizon. So if this is short-term money, it's a cash reserve, or it's something for a building you're going to do next year, wrong place for it. We're investing for the long term. It's going to go up and down. It's highly diversified. We have specialist managers in each asset class, and in some asset classes we have several managers. So if somebody gets it wrong, hopefully the other two get it right. And again, the idea is to let those things offset each other. It's overseen by the UU Investment Committee, and I just want to say it is an outstanding group of people who are investment professionals, and I don't mean they're stock brokers. These are people who manage institutional funds, who manage hundreds of millions of dollars for other institutions, and they're all highly committed UUs. Just looking to see if anybody's here. There's also a socially responsible investment committee that is sort of the conscience of our investing. And I see Reverend Sidney Morris sitting back there. Sidney Morris was the chair on the committee for many years and the chair of the committee for several years. Really key is we use one of the top investment consultants in the nation. It's called New England Pension Consultants. Forget it unless you have a few hundred million dollars. They don't want to talk to you. They only advise institutions, pensions, and large endowments. And they bring a very deep, they have like 60 or 70 researchers. They monitor hundreds of funds, and they help guide our asset allocation targets and our manager selection. So that's a huge benefit. And then I mentioned the SRI committee. The fund is managed to reflect our UU values while achieving the financial goals. A previous investment committee chair said, We're balancing risk, return, and justice. So we're not giving up any one of them. We're trying to do all of it. And over time, the fund has been quite successful. Just to keep going, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Quick last slide.
Quick word on what socially responsible investing is and how it's enacted at the UUA. It's really thinking about what are the impacts of your investments beyond risk and return. What do these investments mean for the broader society? There are three elements to it. One is the actual security selection, and sometimes that takes the form of negative screening. For instance, the GA has told us do not buy tobacco stocks. We don't buy tobacco stocks. Really, our program is much deeper than that. And it's what's called positive screening, or sometimes favor-avoid. And so what our guidance says, and again, it all goes back to General Assembly resolutions, is that there are some behaviors that we want to avoid, let's say negative environmental impact or negative human rights effects. So we want to find the companies that have poor records in those areas and avoid them, and find the companies with the outstanding records, let's say those that adhere to the UN principles for human rights, and weight the portfolio in that direction. So it's a dynamic process. We use a leading SRI research firm that looks at the 1,000 largest companies in the United States, rate them on a whole array of issues, which again come from us. We tell them this is what's important to us. This is not a cookie cutter. They're responding to UUA values, rating these companies, and then what we do then is we weight the portfolio towards the ones that are the better human rights, community impact, employment, all these issues that are important to us, weight it in that direction, avoid the ones at the bottom. And then it's repeated every 6 months because companies change. You know, companies will say, get a lot of pressure from investors, and they'll say, well, okay, maybe we should adopt the UN principles for human rights. And they'll change, and they'll go from avoid this company to now it's someplace we want our money to be. Shareholder advocacy. So when you own the stock, you have a voice, and we exercise that voice. We exercise it on our own, and we exercise it in collaboration with other investors, like the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility. So the theme of this whole GA is interfaith work. I'll tell you, we're in the middle of interfaith work with many other denominations, the Reformed Jews, the Methodists, United Church of Christ. The Catholics are doing fantastic work. And we collaborate with them on many issues of social justice. We bring pressure to bear on companies in their annual meetings through shareholder resolutions and through conversation, because they put it differently, the Catholics. They say, you know, we're all part of the body of Christ. We say we respect the inherent dignity of every person. It means the same thing. So we're looking at these people in their eyes. They're human beings, and we talk about what's important. And the companies change. The companies change. It's very amazing. The last thing is what are called impact investments. So these can be like community loan funds. It can be a solar company. It's where you take your money and invest it very directly to get a positive impact on the community or the world. And the UUA does that through our investments. For you, if you don't want to do the common endowment route, and a lot, total transparency, many congregations choose to do things on their own. There are socially responsible mutual funds you can use. There are SRI advisors who can advise your congregation on how to invest its funds with this kind of an approach. If you don't own the stock, if you just own the mutual funds, you can't vote your proxies, but you can write letters to companies, and you can say, I own your company through this mutual fund, and I'm concerned about this. They listen. And if you own the stock, you can go to the annual general meeting, and you can speak. And we do that. We don't have a big travel budget, so we call on ministers and congregants all over the country to attend annual meetings and speak to those boards of directors about issues that concern us. By the way, I invite any of you who might be interested in doing that to give me your name and where you live. And if we have an annual general meeting pop up in your area, we would be grateful to draw on your talents and time. So now, back to Reverend Laura.
All right, so you've got a lot of great information about the basics of planned gifts and also some basics of endowments, maybe more than basics. That was fantastic, Tim.
Wind me up.
Woo! So how can your UUA help you with this work? We provide brochures and flyers, as I mentioned before, that you can use directly or modify to be more branded with your congregation if you wish. We have an online gift calculator, and I'll be putting, it's at the bottom. So if you go to that website, you'll find the online gift calculator, and we're in the process of improving it now, so it might look a little different if you've been there in the past few years. But what you can do is you can play with this. You can put in your age, if you're thinking about a charitable gift annuity, put in your age, maybe the age of your spouse, how much you're thinking of donating, and it'll show what your approximate tax deduction will be in that year, as well as what your annuity would be. And then if you're thinking, well, what if I wait till next year or 5 years from now, and you can see what your rate of return would be in that way. You can also do it with different kinds of gifts, such as trusts and gifts of real estate. There's a lot of things you can play with there. Interactive presentations, and these are great for learning more about a gift yourself, or if you know someone in your congregation who's interested in, let's say, donating a vacation home, and you're like, well, I think the UUA has some presentations on how that might work, and we do, and you can watch it with them, you can give them the link to it, any way you want to do it, you can learn more about the specifics of these types of gifts. Tim already talked all about the UU Common Endowment Fund, so you can go there and learn more about it. Other ways you can help. You can call my office, and we can talk to you about how to approach a potential gift. Get people calling me all the time from all over the country and sometimes Canada about, we have a woman in our congregation, and she's got a rental property, and she's thinking of maybe donating it to the church. How might that work? I can talk you through the basics of that and how it might work for your congregation. Even simple ones of, we need some bequest language. Absolutely, I can help you out with that. If you're just getting started and you're putting together a gift acceptance policy in your congregation, I can help you out with that as well, give you some examples, talk you through some of the pros and cons of different ways of doing things, and work you through that as well. I can talk directly with people who are thinking about making a planned gift to your congregations about the benefits and differences among various gift plans. Maybe people are thinking of, I've been looking at your website and you have charitable gift annuities and pooled income funds. I'm not really sure what would be best for me, and can absolutely talk to you about that. Maybe you've made a planned gift proposal for someone in your congregation and you just need someone to look it over and see if there's any red flags. Happy to do that. And we also process, manage, and complete gifts through our umbrella giving program. And this is really neat. So umbrella giving is basically you give the gift through the UUA, and you can split it any way you wish between any UU organizations you wish. So this really simplifies estate plans for people. What they can do in their will is they can make their bequest to the UUA and then write us a letter of intent. And that letter says, I want 50% to go to my congregation, 25% to go to the UUA, and 25% to go to the UUSC. And then we will
do
that.
Don't forget the UUA.
Did I not say
that? No, you did. I'm just saying, don't forget the UUA.
Yeah, absolutely. Please don't forget the UUA. but you can split it that way if you wish. And then there's people who perhaps they have several meaningful congregations in their life. So at the time they make the original bequest, they have one particular congregation they've been a member of their whole lives. But then maybe they retire to Florida and they join a congregation there. And that's been really important to them too. So they don't have to change their will, they just need to write us a new letter saying how they'd like to change the distribution of that gift. So maybe 25% to this congregation, 25% to the congregation in Florida, 25% to the UUA. Or 50, we can move it all around. So in this way, people can really simplify how they're giving to Unitarian Universalism and do it in a variety of wonderful ways. All sorts of things qualify: our seminaries, camps and conference centers,
UUSC,
use Ministers Association, all the professional networks, those count, your districts or regions count. There's all sorts of ways to do this. If someone is interested in anonymous giving, they do want to give a planned gift to your congregation, but they don't want you to know about it, send them to me. Let them know that this is a possibility. It can be entirely anonymous through our office. Gives you access to different kinds of planned gifts, like the gift annuities, like the trusts that we can help people with, and also sometimes gifts of stock. We can process that through our umbrella giving program so congregations don't have to deal with that. There's no fees or cost to the donor or congregations for this umbrella giving program. It is supported through all of our contributions to the annual program fund and the other ways we support our UUA, so thank you very much for that. And this is one more level of accountability and stewardship. If someone uses the umbrella giving program for their planned gift, they also become a member of the UUA's Legacy Society. And they're getting thanked that way. They're getting invited to special events that way. They're getting more information about different kinds of planned gifts that way. And there's one more layer of people keeping track of all this. And we've been doing a really good job of this in our office, not to brag, but we've been doing it for a long time, and there's a lot of consistency and longevity in our record keeping. And not to say that not all congregations don't have impeccable record keeping for decades and decades and decades, but sometimes it's nice to have some backup. So this is great. We have something called a Legacy Challenge, and there's going to, this is new, very, very new, and there's going to be more information announced about it tomorrow during general session, so I recommend, if you can, to go and hear about that. But this is going to be very exciting for all of our congregations and Unitarian Universalism in general. This Legacy Challenge is going to bring more information to our congregations about planned giving and also inspire more people to give planned gifts through a match. So stay tuned. So to summarize, what are our recommendations to take back to your congregation? Utilize a planned giving committee. It doesn't have to be large. Few people devoted to promoting planned giving in your congregation is all it takes. Create a recognition society. Give them information a couple times a year, up to four. Host some sort of annual event, such as a tea or an outing. And or beer, that sounds good. And also get testimonials from the people in your Legacy Society. Utilize my office. Give us a call. Just say hi. Tell us what you're working on. We can help you. We'd just love to hear about what's going on as well. And we can connect you to other congregations that might be nearby that are also doing the same work. Remember alumni. We talked about this earlier, but it's really important. Remember the people who've moved away. And remember to honor those who've passed away. At least once a year in some service, have a time of honoring these people. A lot of congregations do it around All Souls Day. So don't give tax or financial advice. We're giving information, and this goes for myself as well as all of you. We like to give information, but not advice. We don't want any conflict of interest to come up. That's just a messy moral situation. We just don't want to go there. So no advice, just information. Remember that you're representing your congregation in this. And if you're having a conversation with someone and red flags are maybe going up in your head or your spidey sense is tingling that something's not quite right, trust that, take a step back, confer with someone else. A lot of times with this, there's issues of competency and that sort of thing as people age. So we want to be very mindful of that. And not push people who might be vulnerable into anything they don't want to be doing. So something to be mindful of. So while you can't give advice, you can give examples. Give an example of what you did. Give an example of what someone you know did or other examples of that way. That's a great way to tell people about planned giving is, well, you know, what I did is I just went on my IRA's webpage and it took me 10 minutes and I made the UUA a beneficiary of my retirement plan and it was so easy. True story. Encourage seeking professional advice. So you can give information and then always ask people to speak to their own accountant or financial planner about what is best for their particular situation. And if you have any questions about this at all, you can always call my office or you can call Tim or your own legal counsel if you have it. We've come to the time for questions and comments. I encourage anyone who's going to ask something to come up to the microphone because this is being recorded for accessibility. And if you can't get to the microphone, simply raise your hand and we'll bring you a cordless mic and you can ask it from your chair.
Thank you. I'm from the San Luis Obispo, California. And we followed a lot of these things from a similar presentation last year and had some good success. But our Society of Legacy Builders that we created is what we named it. There's some concern about are we promoting people who are just giving money, and are we not promoting people who have done other good things for the congregation? And it almost stopped it this year, and we finally got it over. But how do you argue that so that I can make that argument for us?
Sure. This comes up a lot of people concerned about equity with recognition societies. We'd like to point out that thanking people for what they've done is always important. And you can set your own parameters about how people are welcomed into your legacy society or not. We do it with any intention. So we don't ask for proof of this gift that they're giving. And there's so many ways to give legacy gifts through, like I said, retirement plans, gifts of life insurance, wills, these gift annuities, all sorts of ways to give a legacy gift that we really hope it is accessible to as many people as possible. And this isn't to keep people out, but it is to invite people in and lift up their intention for what they hope lives beyond them. So it's not meant to be divisive. And if there's a particular situation, feel free to call me and we can talk it out as well.
What would you say is a minimum for the members and contribution amount for recognition of society and charter members? And also, does this include, would that include donor advised funds and charitable remainder trusts? I'm a little confused about that one subject on that.
So. Sure. I don't recommend having a minimum amount. I think any legacy gift gets you into the society, even as a charter member. The UUA doesn't do donor advised funds. We know you can do it through other community funds and that sort of thing. So, yes, I would say that would count. If that's something a donor can do and has done for your congregation, absolutely, that'll count. And charitable remainder trusts, absolutely. If they've set up a charitable remainder trust and put your congregation in it, that's phenomenal. They're in.
Just one qualifier on that is that the charitable gift annuities, at least through the UUA, it does have a minimum of $10,000 on it.
That's true. So there are certain
gifts. And that's because there's a whole administrative piece to getting the thing set up and costs for us that mm-hmm. you don't pay. From State Street Bank, so we do place a $10,000 minimum on that.
Absolutely, and when people are setting up trusts, they should know that there's usually a $100,000 minimum for most trusts to be set up, so it is a different kind of level of giving.
Yeah, and just one other quick thing to respond to you. I used to be a member at the Unitarian Church in Westport, Connecticut, and when I was there, I somehow became the chair of the 50th anniversary capital campaign. I guess I wasn't paying attention. Our push was that everybody should participate. We mm-hmm. said we wanted everybody to participate. We wanted everybody on the list, and it didn't matter what the size of the gift was. And it was extremely successful. We had 85% of the members of the congregation ended up giving to that fund. Some of them were giving $200, but that's what they could do. So I think you can take a similar approach to this. I mean, just put the congregation in the will and say they're going to get, $500. And that's fantastic. That's fantastic. And you thank them as much as you would thank anybody else.
Right. And part of this is a broader mission of helping people understand what wills are and what happens if you die without one. And even if you can just conscious raising awareness with that in your congregation that gets more people to create a will, that's huge. Yes.
Yeah, I would just echo the part about percentage giving. We do that not only for our capital campaign, but also for our general stewardship campaign, so that people who commit a certain percentage, whether they're on public assistance or they're the VP of Exxon, are all can sit at the same table. And people get the percentage. I mean, it's with the gift model and the APF and all that. So two questions. One is, it's generally acknowledged that index funds do better over the long term than managed funds. And so I'm wondering if the UUA Common Endowment Fund, where we have our $500,000 invested, if it beats the S&P 500 with some regularity. That's just a one question. And the second question is, you stressed make it easy, but then there's also the complexity piece. So when I go on the UUA website, not recently, but a while ago, to look for endowment stuff, it always ends with, you know, here's some words, here's ideas, and consult your financial advisor. So I don't want to give a brochure to somebody and say, this is really easy, these are the steps, these are the types of things you can do, and go by the way, now go on the internet, redo your research, find a financial, that's just like too many steps, and my concern is that people will say, they'll smile, I'm not dying this week, I'll do this someday, one of those life incidents that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So does it always end with consult your financial advisor? Because that then should be part of the strategy about how to really get people connected. It seems to me that's a pretty big hurdle. So are we beating the index funds with these managed funds? And is there any way to streamline that call to action piece at the end?
I'm going to hand the first question to you.
So I know just the research you're talking about. If you think about the whole market, if any fund beats the market average, there has to be somebody else who lost, right? I mean, because it's – so that's where that research comes from. But the truth of the matter is there are managers who do pretty consistently beat the market averages. The way we manage our U.S. equities is that a little over half of it is in an index fund. Now, it's an index fund we created. It's a custom index fund that does this favoring the good SRI performers and leaving out the poor performers. Interestingly, it hits the benchmark. We pay 12 basis points, in other words, 0.12% for the management of that because there are no decisions being made. It's just going through a computer. So we do that. We also have an active large cap manager. It's a very few positions, like 20, 25 positions, and they have been remarkably successful over a very long term. I mean, they've been there as long as I have, and they've been over the long term, they beat it. And then what other research will show is that and the reason that managers have a hard time beating those benchmark averages in the large cap is because the information is so pervasive. It's hard to have an information advantage. But when you start getting into smaller cap stocks, the information is not nearly as pervasive. And so managers that do really good fundamental research, some of them can be successful and beat the benchmarks. So in our small cap managers, we do use active managers. That help?
Yeah, and the make it simple part?
Make it simple part. Having a wide variety of gifts is the key to this. Making a bequest is fairly simple, but it does require making a will, and it can be done either through an attorney or online. If you're making a simple will, there's plenty of really standard good will writing technology online. Also, beneficiary designation forms are the simplest way to give a planned gift. Like I said, what I did was taking my retirement account. It took 10 minutes, and it just said that 10% of this is going to go to the UUA someday.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Is there a minimum threshold to participate in the UU Common Endowment, and what might that be?
Yeah, it's only $10,000, which is actually way too little if you were in a commercial enterprise. But what we're trying to do is to encourage congregations to get started. So you get your $10,000 started, and then you can, through your legacy giving program, say, we have this fund, and it's ready to accept legacy gifts, bequests, and others. And then you can grow it. And you pay the same, by the way. There's no fee to get in. There's no fee to get out. You have total liquidity every month. If you decide we're idiots, you can pull the money out at the end of the month. And the management fee overall is right about 1%. And that includes everything. There are no add-ons or extra fees. It's about 1%.
And is the $10,000 the same for umbrella giving, the umbrella giving program?
The umbrella giving program is for an email.
Good. Okay.
I mean, if you give us $10, we'll still do it, but don't do that.
Thank you.
Yes, hi. Thank you for your information. It was great learning. You mentioned an investment team, an investment committee, thinking about how best to invest an endowment. And you also mentioned, well, maybe you don't want to pay out income right away. You want to have an accumulation period. And I wanted to know a little bit about if you can recommend guidelines or not just leaving it to the discretion. In other words, let's, for example, say the endowment may equal a year of the operating budget. Is it wise to start paying, you know, paying out money? Or I think, personally, I think it would be wiser to wait, but that's a guideline that I wonder if you have a suggestion about.
Yeah, I don't think there are any standard guidelines. I think it depends on the mission and strategy of the congregation. I guess the one guideline I would have is, you know, back to that principle of intergenerational equity. What I think does not make sense and is questionable is to say, okay, we aren't going to pay out anything until we've got $1 million. And by the way, we started 10 years ago, and we're at 100,000. It's like at some point you go, wait a minute, these people gave you the money in order to do a payout, in order to benefit the congregation. So I think what would make sense is to say, you know, to have two goals, to say, you know, our goal is $1 million, but if we don't get there in 5 years, we're going to start paying out some reasonable amount. That's how I would do it. And I guess the other thing is to kind of turn it around and say, okay, let's just say, you know, simple math, we're going to assume a 5% payout rate. At what point is it meaningful? And it'll vary from congregation to congregation. I mean, you might say, you know, we're going to start paying out at 100,000 because actually if we can take 5,000 out, we're going to make a grant to a local social justice organization. And $5,000 would be a lot of money. It would be meaningful. On the other hand, you know, you have a congregation with a budget of, you know, $2 million a year and you're going to use it for operations. Well, like, what's the point of $5,000? You know, we're going to wait until we, you know, have a million and we can have 50,000 and then it's meaningful. So I think those would be the two tests, I'd say. Thank you.
I'm from Peterborough, New Hampshire, and we have a nice endowment. We also have a huge historic building. And so we've had endowment wars over the last 20, 25 years that I've been part of the congregation. Snapshot, in the 90s, we had an endowment that was probably $500,000. It was actively managed by members of our congregation.
I didn't mention that. That's also not such a good idea.
Okay, well,
how do you fire
we've
them?
Grown up since then. Let me finish the story. And we had a process of taking 5% out of the endowment every year and just using it for whatever the church was doing. We were told a number of things that, one, some members would say, never touch the principal. We decided to do handicapped access in the mid-90s, you know, elevator, ramp space, all that kind of stuff. We did a capital campaign of $200,000 to do this stuff, but during construction, suddenly there was other stuff that needed to be done for another $1,000 or $70,000. Should we take it out of the endowment or what? You know, we did, but there was a lot of fighting about that. Then there was also always the message that you shouldn't be using your thing from the endowment for your operations. You know, that you should be doing that with pledges. So there's always that tension in a congregation. Mm-hmm. So after all those wars were over, we set up a committee to do an endowment restructuring. There was a lot of the endowment money that had been, this is for the building, you know, this historic building. And we have one fund which is dedicated to flowers at Easter.
And I know what you're talking about.
And now everybody in the congregation gets to take home two or three pots of daffodils and tulips every year. So that's the problem with those restricted endowments. In the early aughts, we had a committee that we decided to restructure the endowment funds and purposes, because a lot of it had been restricted for the care of the building. And some of it we felt we'd also heard, well, you've got this big endowment, you're not doing any social outreach. So we decided to set up a social services fund. And then we left a small portion of it that would be to ongoing operational expenses, and it includes the Easter flowers. And we actually intended that part of it to be diminished, and we'd wean ourselves off of that. And that's generally how it's worked. The building part of the fund is great because all the big capital work that needs to be done on the building, like re-roofing it every 20 years and all that kind of, it can be taken care of by the fund. And our relatively small congregation, for the church the size we have, is relieved of that financial duty. All right. Over time, and back in the 90s, we had a number
There are more people, so if you could get to your question, it'd be great.
Okay. So we had some, you know, big regular donors back in the 90s. And what we found is a lot of them have passed on. And we're now in a crunch where we don't have those big donors, but also now people have passed on. We realize we've missed the opportunity for the planned giving. And so that's why I'm here, is to get. Anyway, this is just sort of lessons from somebody who's been through it. Mm-hmm. And we're here, I'm soaking up the planned giving part. So,
cool, give me a call.
I'm a first-time delegate, and I understand there's a proposal to divest that will be voted on. Can you tell us what impact, if that passes, what impact that would have on this endowment fund and how it's managed?
Well, as moderator Key said earlier, there's been a lot of work going on that I'm just kind of peripherally aware of about making changes to that proposal. So I just qualify it with that. So, you know, I have not seen the final proposal, so it's different from what's in your book. What I would say is that going back to what I was saying about our approach of doing the screening and the analysis of all of our all the stocks on a wide range of issues, including human rights, is that we don't actually own the five stocks that were mentioned in the original proposal, so it wouldn't have any effect. So I should be totally transparent here. I guess the difference would be, as I say, we go back and we look every 6 months at the performance and policies of the companies. So if one of these companies changed, which they do, it could become eligible and come back into the portfolio if through our SRI research firm they said their score has risen to a certain point, then it could be eligible for investment again. Does that help?
I think so.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good.
Hi, I'm from the congregation from the other Columbus in Indiana. I've got a couple of questions that relate to plan giving more in the current term versus after you're gone, and three questions, and I think they'll be easily answered. Qualified charitable distributions to satisfy an RMD, mm-hmm. Are you putting that into your discussion for plan giving?
You absolutely can, and we can work with you with that in our office as well. If you are 70 and a half or older and you have the required distribution from your IRAs, we can roll that over as a charitable distribution. Take it, and you can either have it go directly to your congregation, or you can use our umbrella giving program to disperse it to several UU organizations, including the UUA.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're pretty gray. Yes. When we receive stock, whether it's from a bequest or for operating funds, we typically sell the stock right away. Mm-hmm. To avoid losses. Is this typical of most congregations? They divest the stock and sort of move on rather than try to manage the stock?
That's what we recommend. It's what we do at the UUA. I'm not actually sure what most congregations do.
Yeah, most charities do that, and that's because, you know, you don't want to be in the business of market timing, mm-hmm. Because you'll be wrong more often than you'll be right. And your investment portfolio hopefully is being managed with an overview and a strategy. And if suddenly then you've got, you know, $500,000 of Exxon stock, it throws the whole thing off. Better to liquidate it and then put it back into your whole portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And the last question is around plan giving. We have a small endowment. We're still taking baby steps in terms of plan giving and endowments. We'll focus some time this year, but have congregations voiced to you that they've experienced an impact on their annual stewardship campaign once the plan giving is promoted? Sort of like you can only go to the wells so many times?
Sure. Almost every congregation raises that concern, and I've yet to see that happen because legacy giving is it's not current money. So when you're making a bequest, that's making a bequest of assets you don't need anymore. So it's not exhausting people in that way. You're not asking them for the same money. It's when we like to think that they're complementary, to say you're making a gift now and would you consider also supporting the congregation after you're gone. And so we recommend you put some plan giving language on every piece of stewardship material you send out, including on pledge forms and things. Just at the bottom, a little checkbox that says, I have included this congregation in my estate plans, or I would like more information on how to do so. And just those two questions or statements put it in people's mind that it's a possibility. It's one more way of consciousness raising.
Okay, but endowments, building endowments can be used with current assets mm-hmm. and future assets. It's those current assets that I'm thinking about. Generally, it has no impact.
I haven't seen an impact.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose you can overdo anything, but I haven't seen that happen yet because they do tend to be two different sources of money mm-hmm. for people.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that it is noon, and if people need to go, I want to honor your time and thank you very much. I'm willing to stay here for questions as long as you need to.
Thank you. One quick horror story which got me into this session. Bequest of $70,000 for a church library where what existed was a bookcase.
Okay.
A good news story, the chair of the endowment committee did not have a heart attack in our annual meeting when he spoke about the horrors of using his endowment to air condition the RE building in South Florida. Okay, question, can on your website or somewhere help us decide on the spending and distribution policy, when can it include like a capital outlay beyond just the annual 5% distribution? Don't answer that now if I can find it somewhere else.
You can find it online, and I suggest you take one of my cards and email me because I'd like to ask you some more questions about your particular situation and see if I can get you the best resources to
help
you
with that.
Okay,
thank you.
My question is very specific to the congregation, so I could talk to you.
Yeah, that's fine. Why don't you come on up?
Yeah. Hi, guys. I'm Ward Kelsey from Pittsburgh. I have a couple of comments and a quick question. The comments have to do with some of the advice that you've been getting here that I'm sort of sharing my experience with you. One of the things that you talked about, Tim, is the idea of a quasi-endowment, okay, and the notion that a quasi-endowment is essentially one that's been restricted by the voluntary choice of the recipient organization, and usually it's the Board of Trustees, but theoretically it can be undone. Well, one of the things you can do to sort of calm people's nerves about that and sort of avoid having a plethora of restricted gifts is to do what our church has done, which is to have a bylaw that says there is now created a fund called the Endowment Fund. And the Endowment Fund cannot be simply undone at the whim of the board. It requires, in our case, it requires a sort of a supermajority vote of the congregation, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I would say if you do that, and I like the idea of having a bylaw, make sure that, A, you make some kind of a general statement about what the endowment fund is for, which nobody in our group did, and, B, you have, if you can, some sort of general guidance about the investment policy you want to see applied to the fund, again, just because it sort of helps the people have to manage it. Okay. Second thing I was going to say is, this is a plug for you guys. We have a pretty good sized endowment fund at this point. And we also have an investment committee, also created by bylaw, that's responsible for deciding how to allocate that money. And over the years, I've been pushing them to get everything into the UU Common Endowment Fund, but we still have a bunch of sort of technical managers stuck on the fund, our group. And so once a year, we have to go through this horrible, painful process of juggling about 23 other investments mm-hmm. in order to rebalance, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's only recently they've had enough people who even cared about that sort of thing and knew what they were talking about. So I would strongly encourage folks, unless you have a very large amount of money and some very sophisticated money managers in your congregation, don't get yourself in a situation where you have to start individually rebalancing your investments if you possibly can avoid it. Now, my question is this. Every now and then, when I send some money into one of our sort of direct action kind of investments, I get a nice letter back from them saying, oh, thanks, and by the way, your UUA just matched your gift. Would somebody explain how that works? Because I'm just always amazed. I mean, I send $10,000 into OICO, and lo and behold, OICO writes back and says, oh, thanks, you just gave us $20,000, you know? And I know I had heard about it, but I just don't know quite how that works.
Yeah, thanks for that plug. So, yeah, we have what's called a community investing matching fund. So if a congregation makes an investment, not a contribution, an investment in a community investment fund, you know, a community investment housing fund or microcredit or whatever, and they submit the application to us, then the UUA will match that with another $10,000. We make the investment ourselves. So it's just the idea is just to incent congregations to do more community investing.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.